Land trusts and other conservation organizations often take over the long-term stewardship responsibilities for wetlands, streams, and other aquatic resources that are restored, enhanced, created, or preserved as compensatory mitigation under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. Before taking on such responsibility, these organizations should be well armed with the skills necessary to navigate the Section 404 program. This webcast will discuss the basics of the Section 404 program, as well as the basics of compensatory mitigation, including mitigation policy, mitigation methods, and mitigation mechanisms. Speakers will also provide an overview of the roles and risks of becoming involved in mitigation. Finally, speakers will provide a review of methods to evaluate stewardship tasks, calculate an adequate long-term stewardship endowment, and guarantee long-term funding. At this point, I'm going to introduce our three speakers for today's webcast. Palmer Huff is an environmental scientist at EPA headquarters in Washington, D.C., where he serves as EPA's Wetlands Regulatory Program team leader and as EPA's national lead on wetlands mitigation issues. Before coming to headquarters, he worked on wetlands regulatory protection and planning issues across the southeastern U.S. for EPA's Region 4 office in Atlanta, Georgia. Some of you may see Rebecca Kisslinger as our second speaker. However, due to illness, Jessica Wilkinson will be speaking in today's webcast instead. Jessica is a senior science and policy analyst at the Environmental Law Institute in Washington, D.C. As director of ELI's Wetlands Program, she oversees the Institute's Program of Wetlands Research. She was the lead author of several of ELI's wetlands publications. Finally, we have Deborah Rogers. Dr. Deborah Rogers is a director of conservation science for the Center of Natural Lands Management. The center is a nonprofit environmental organization that manages habitat across the state of California, including wetland mitigation sites. So, now that I've introduced our speakers, let's get started. Palmer, take it away.
Thank you, Megan. Good afternoon or good morning for folks tuning in from the West Coast. I'm Palmer Huff. I'm with EPA's Wetlands Program, and I'm your first of three speakers in today's webcast. And if you've seen the flyer for the webcast, I'm by far the least attractive of today's speakers. At least one person told me that the mugshot included for me on the flyer looks a bit more like the cartoon character Shrek, only with a little bit of hair and a 5 o'clock shadow. I'm not nearly as entertaining as Shrek, but I'm going to do my best to try and keep you engaged. I'm on slide two. I just want to introduce my part of the presentation by giving folks a little bit of background. Each year, tens of thousands of acres of land containing complexes of restored wetlands and streams are set aside as compensatory mitigation under the federal government's Clean Water Act Section 404 program. As the moderator, Megan, noted, land trusts and other conservation organizations are increasingly being asked to take over the long-term stewardship responsibilities of compensatory mitigation sites. While the increased involvement of land trusts and other dedicated conservation organizations in the stewardship of conservation sites is a good trend from an environmental standpoint, we want to ensure that land trusts and other conservation organizations have the resources and training they need to adequately assume these responsibilities. While our target audience for this webcast is primarily land trusts and other conservation organizations, we recognize that the information we're going to provide is likely of interest to other groups involved in compensatory mitigation, such as personnel from federal, state, and local resource agencies and natural and regulatory agencies, as well as environmental consultants and other compensation providers. And I believe we have a number of representatives from all of these organizations on today's webcast. My job today is to open up the webcast with a primer on compensatory mitigation so that everybody knows what we mean by the term compensatory mitigation, why we do it, how we do it, and who provides it. Moving on to slide three, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the 404 permitting program. I'm going to touch briefly on the agency roles of the different federal and state agencies that play a part in the 404 program. I'm going to touch briefly on the permitting process and how compensatory mitigation fits into it. I'm going to cover some of the key aspects of compensatory mitigation policy, compensatory mitigation methods, and finally, the different mechanisms for providing compensatory mitigation. As you can see on slide four, by way of background, in 1972, Congress overhauled the Federal Water Pollution Control Act. It's now more popularly known as the Clean Water Act. The primary goal of the Clean Water Act is to restore and protect chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. To help achieve that goal, Section 404 of the Act requires a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in order to discharge what's called dredged or fill material into waters of the U.S. And then waters of the U.S. is a term that includes wetlands. As part of the permit program, impacts must be avoided and minimized. Often for remaining unavoidable impacts, the Corps of Engineers may require compensatory mitigation to replace or offset lost aquatic resource functions and area. Moving on to slide 5, there are a variety of agencies involved in the 404 program. The Corps and EPA co-administer the Section 404 program. The Corps does most of the heavy lifting administering the day-to-day responsibilities of the permit program, while EPA develops the environmental criteria used by the Corps in making permit decisions. The EPA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service all review and comment on proposed permit actions and have a variety of mechanisms for elevating their concerns on proposed projects. The states can play a variety of roles in the 404 program as well. However, their role differs from state to state. For example, states have the ability to condition 404 permits. States can take over the administration of large or small parts of the permit program itself, and many states have also passed their own state statutes to create state regulatory programs that complement the 404 program. Moving on to slide 6, so what exactly is regulated under the 404 program? In general, placement of fill material into waters of the U.S. for a variety of commercial, residential, and industrial development, construction of dikes, levees, dams, removal and disposal of dredge material in waters of the U.S., as well as mechanical land clearing and many types of excavation that are conducted in waters of the U.S. Ultimately, all these regulated activities result in between 80 to 100,000 core permit actions each year. Moving on to slide 7. So how are these permits evaluated? The permit evaluation process in the 404 program is quite famously complex, particularly for large projects or projects that propose impacts to sensitive aquatic resources. But it generally follows a three-step sequence of avoidance, minimization, and lastly, compensation. This sequence is rooted in the program's substantive environmental criteria, known as the Section 404B1 guidelines. The current version of these guidelines was finalized by EPA in 1980. In 1990, EPA and the Corps signed a memorandum of agreement that describes the procedures for complying with the guidelines mitigation sequence. You have a link to the 1990 MOA and the additional materials handout that goes along with this webcast. Looking at slide 8 gives you an idea of the volume of impacts and mitigation that are required each year in the 404 program. Just looking at 1 year, for example, in 2003, permit applicants requested impacts to over 27,000 acres of wetlands and other waters. After evaluating these impacts, the Corps ultimately permitted impacts to approximately 21,000 acres and avoided impacts to approximately 5,800 acres. To offset these permitted losses, the Corps then required over 4,300 acres of compensatory mitigation. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit more, moving on to slide 9. Focusing on compensatory mitigation, we define compensatory mitigation as those actions that are taken to replace aquatic resources that are lost to authorized but unavoidable impacts. It's through compensation that the federal government strives to meet its long-standing goal of wetlands, no net loss. And typically we talk and think about no net loss in terms of no net loss of functions and area. The program has a long-standing minimum one-to-one replacement ratio for compensatory mitigation. This was first articulated in the 1990 Memorandum of Agreement that I mentioned on slide 7. It's important to note, however, that the replacement ratio for a given compensation project is often higher than one-to-one once other factors such as risk of project failure and temporal loss are considered. Another important factor in determining the compensation ratio for a project is the method of compensation. In general, there are four flavors or methods of compensation. We talk about aquatic resource creation, restoration, enhancement, and preservation. on slide 10, you can see that creation involved creating a wetland or other aquatic resource where one did not previously exist. This particular freshwater wetland was created in Massachusetts to compensate for impacts resulting from a nearby commercial development. On slide 11, you can see that restoration involves bringing back a wetland where one had existed historically. In this case, this involved the restoration of a shallow marsh in Minnesota to compensate for impacts associated with a nearby highway project. On slide 12, you can see that enhancement takes an existing wetland and improves one or more of the functions that particular wetland provides. And in this example, the hydroperiod of an existing wetland that had been formerly farmed in Puerto Rico was increased to enhance the habitat for waterfowl, that one particular function. On slide 13, you can see that preservation simply protects an existing intact resource from destruction in the future. And in this particular case, this particular project involved the preservation of a smooth cord grass salt marsh in Texas in order to compensate for impacts to a nearby tidal marsh. As the previous slides illustrate, creation and restoration replace lost aquatic resource area and functions, while enhancement only replaces lost functions. And by contrast, preservation replaces neither lost area nor lost functions. So its use as compensation in the 404 program has been limited historically. Slide 14 gives you an idea of how much of each four of these methods of compensation is approved in a typical year. A recent detailed evaluation by the Environmental Law Institute revealed that over two-thirds of compensation done annually comes in the form of restoration and enhancement, while less than 15% is done through preservation. Moving on to slide 15, who's providing this compensation? In general, there are three mechanisms for providing compensatory mitigation in the 404 program, and they fall into two categories. One we call permittee responsible compensation, and the second is called third party compensation. In permittee responsible compensation, the permittee does the work or hires a contractor to do the work. However, responsibility and liability for completing the work and guaranteeing its success remain with the permittee. In third party mitigation, a permittee pays someone else to do the work, either a mitigation banker or an in lieu fee sponsor, and that third party accepts the responsibility and the liability for completing that work and ensuring its long-term success. The vast majority of compensatory mitigation done annually is still permittee responsible compensation, almost 60%, while mitigation banking has been a rapidly growing form of compensation in recent years. In-lieu fee currently provides about 8.5% of the compensation done annually on an acreage basis. Slide 16 touches briefly on some of the existing policy and guidance associated with these various mechanisms of compensation. In 1985, the federal agencies released guidance for mitigation banking. In 2000, the federal agencies released guidance on in-lieu fee mitigation. And in 2002, the Corps and EPA jointly released guidance that provides additional direction for permittee responsible compensation. You can find links to all of these documents on the additional resources list that was prepared for this webcast. On slide 17, you'll note a proposed rulemaking that the Corps and EPA are currently in the midst of. In an effort to synthesize all these various guidance documents into one comprehensive set of regulations for compensatory mitigation, last spring EPA and the Corps released a proposed set of compensatory mitigation regulations with a goal of setting equivalent and effective standards for all three forms of compensation. The Corps and EPA relied heavily on recommendations provided in a recent National Research Council report on compensation. And the Corps and EPA are currently evaluating the over 12,000 comment letters we received on these proposed compensation regulations and expect to release a final rule sometime later this year. Links to both the NRC study and this proposed rulemaking can also be found on the additional resources document that was prepared for this webcast. I want to spend the next few slides talking in a little bit more detail about the three mechanisms of compensation. On slide 18, you'll see a little bit about how permittee responsible compensation works. In permittee responsible compensation, the permittee, or more likely a consultant or contractor hired by the permittee, proposes the project, revises the project in response to agency concerns, is responsible for implementing the project, monitoring the project, conducting any necessary remediation if problems develop on the site. And the permittee is also required to provide long-term protection and management for the compensation site. If the permittee doesn't want to provide that long-term stewardship, he is responsible for finding and funding a long-term steward approved by the Corps to provide these services. On slide 19, in contrast, you can see that mitigation banking is a bit more complex. Mitigation banks are defined as an aquatic resource area that's been restored, created, enhanced, or preserved, which is then set aside to compensate for authorized impacts, for future authorized impacts to wetlands. On slide 20, you'll see the three basic components that that really set mitigation banks apart from the other forms of compensation. Mitigation banks have a comprehensive document associated with them called the Mitigation Banking Instrument. These documents contain most or all the details associated with site restoration, protection, and long-term management. The review and approval of banks is guided by an interagency team composed of representatives from the Corps, EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and state agencies. And each bank has a geographic service area within which it can compensate for permitted losses in accordance with its approved instrument. Slide 21 gets into a little bit more detail about how banks work. In general, banks' value are defined by what's called mitigation credits. The Interagency Mitigation Bank Review Team approves the total potential credits that are available for sale at each bank using a variety of assessment tools combined with best professional judgment. These credits are released over time as specific ecological standards and administrative requirements are met on the ground at the bank site. In this respect, banks are often described as having a performance-based form of crediting. Slide 22 just shows you who are really behind mitigation banks. As you can see, the sponsors of more than 70% of mitigation banks are private entrepreneurs, but nonprofits, federal, state, and local government agencies also sponsor banks. Slide 23 gives you a little bit of information about trends of mitigation banks since 1992. As of 2005, there were over 330 active, approved individual mitigation banks. 75 banks had already sold out, and there were 169 banks in the review pipeline. This graphic does not include umbrella banks, which are mitigation banks that have multiple sites associated with them. As of 2006, the Environmental Law Institute estimated that there were over 30 umbrella banks operating across the country, and collectively, these umbrella banks have hundreds of sites associated with their 33 instruments. Slide 24 gives you some idea of how mitigation banks are geographically distributed. It's important to note that individual bank sites are not evenly distributed across the country for a variety of reasons. Banking has been very successful in states such as California, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, and Illinois, while other states have few or no banks. Slide 25, I just want to spend a little bit of time giving you one example of a mitigation bank for folks who aren't familiar with the topic. This is the Everglades Mitigation Bank from South Florida. On slide 26, you'll see that this bank site involves about 1,350 acres. It's operated by the Florida Power and Light Company. It's currently in its first phase of development. The first phase is 4,200 acres. And those 4,200 acres have yielded approximately 391 credits, three types of credits. There's freshwater forested credits, freshwater herbaceous credits, and saltwater herbaceous credits. These credits were estimated using an assessment tool called WATER, which stands for Wetland Assessment Technique for Environmental Review. And as you can see from the prices of these credits, price of a mitigation banking credit in South Florida can be fairly high. I want to wrap up starting on slide 27 with some description of the third and final compensation mechanism. It's known as endless fee mitigation. It's when a permittee provides funds to an approved third party in lieu of doing permittee responsible mitigation or purchasing credits from mitigation bank, you have what's called in lieu fee mitigation. There, a third-party sponsor incurs the cost of doing the work, accepts the liability for conducting the work and ensuring its success, but that in lieu fee sponsor may transfer that stewardship to another entity. On slide 28, you can see that in lieu fee sponsors first must sign an agreement with the Corps As part of that agreement, the sponsor agrees to accept funds based typically on a pre-approved fee schedule. Once the sponsor has collected sufficient amount of funds, the sponsor will go out and conduct a mitigation project. The Corps generally has to review, approve, and conduct oversight for these programs, including the individual projects approved under each program. As you can see on slide 29, within LUFI mitigation, the mitigation work generally is not done in advance of impact, so we do get temporal loss within LUFI programs. Typically, LUFI programs are targeted towards compensating for some of the smaller impacts that are authorized under the program. On slide 30, you can see the makeup of the folks who are generally the sponsors for LUFI programs. By and large, they're mostly nonprofit organizations, but we also have state agencies and local government agencies sponsoring numerous LUFI programs across the country. On slide 31, you can see that in general, the number of LUFI programs peaked around 2001 and in more recent years have begun to decline. As of 2005, the Corps of Engineers calculated that there were approximately 58 LUFI programs operating across the country, with about 7 in the proposal pipeline at that time. Slide 32 is just a short example of one of those numerous LUFI programs. This is an example from Georgia. The Georgia Wetlands Land Trust was established in 1997. Through a cooperative agreement between the Georgia Land Trust Service Center and the Savannah District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Through this agreement, the Land Trust Service Center collects fees from permit applicants who don't have other mitigation options and then pools those fees together and makes them available to local partners such as land trusts and government agencies who can apply for those funds and then go out and conduct mitigation projects on their own. To date, this particular land trust has transferred over $2.5 million to local partners for the permanent preservation of habitat. As you can see on slide 33, regardless of whether the compensation project is permittee responsible mitigation, in lieu fee associated mitigation project, or mitigation bank, all mitigation plans must have certain key elements. I put an asterisk by the components of a mitigation plan that are of likely most interest to long-term stewards. And it's these 4 or 5 components that the next speaker will spend a lot more time going into detail on. I want to wrap up my part of the talk on slide 33 by just closing with highlighting one of the recommendations that was provided by the National Research Council in its recent evaluation of compensatory mitigation. The National Research Council recognized that long-term stewardship is critical and strongly recommended that every compensation site receive long-term stewardship, specifically that the long-term stewards for these sites receive an easement on or title to the site and a cash contribution for the long-term monitoring and management of the site. The next two talks are going to drill much deeper into the details of compensatory mitigation site stewardship. Thank you for your patience, and I think we're going to open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you, Palmer. If everyone could please go to slide 35, we do have some time for a few questions, and we're going to begin with those submitted online. And just as a reminder, you can submit questions online at any time by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Our first question comes from Tracy in Oregon, and she asks how mitigation applies or has been applied to impacts to streams and riparian areas.
That's a really good question. The 404 program, although we typically focus a lot on the impacts we regulate in wetlands and the compensation required for impacts to wetlands, the 404 program regulates all discharges of dredge or fill into waters of the U.S., so that includes not just wetlands but also streams. And as with wetlands, after proposed impacts to streams are avoided and minimized, the Corps, working with the other agencies and the permit applicant, looks for appropriate ways to compensate for unavoidable impacts to streams and riparian areas. Certainly the policy as well as the science and technology for stream mitigation has lagged somewhat behind wetland mitigation. But in the last decade or so, there's been a great deal of research and emphasis on the part of the agencies on focusing on appropriate ways to compensate for impacts to streams. There are, in parts of the country, particularly in the Southeast, already online dozens of stream mitigation banks where segments or complexes of streams have been restored, enhanced, and protected in perpetuity to compensate for impacts to streams in the adjacent watersheds or service areas of those banks.
Okay, our second question comes from Morgan in D.C., and the question is, how big are most bank sites and non-bank sites?
Wow, good question. I don't have off the tip of my tongue the average size of a given bank site. They can range from as small as 10 or 20 acres to, in certain parts of the country, over 1,000. I'm familiar with at least one bank that's approximately 8,000 acres in Florida. By contrast, non-bank sites, well, the permittee responsible mitigation sites, can be very small, from fractions of an acre to 5 to 10 acres, sometimes for large projects that do permittee responsible compensation. We have seen permittee responsible compensation project sites as large as several hundred acres.
All right, let's take one more question from online, and this is actually also from Morgan in D.C., and he would like to know, are most compensation sites in urban, suburban, or rural areas, and why?
With these kind of questions, it's tough to generalize. Some recent studies that have looked at where compensation projects have taken place in particular parts of the country, I'm thinking of a few studies in Florida, have noted that a great deal of compensation that's now happening off-site is often happening outside the urban and suburban areas where the impacts are taking place. The compensation is being cited in more rural areas. Primarily, that's driven by, at least from the resource agency standpoint, that's driven by concerns about ensuring that these sites are sustainable. And there is concern about restoring and enhancing and trying to protect wetland and stream complexes in areas that are undergoing rapid development. So for a number of reasons, many compensation sites are being located in more remote areas. That said, there is a desire on the part of the federal and state resource agencies to ensure that compensation isn't taking place too far away from the impact site, and that communities that are losing wetland and stream resources are seeing those replaced nearby.
Okay, at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself, give us your name and organization, and then ask your question.
Hale Thurston, US EPA.
Go ahead.
I wondered how the credits are determined. Is that per acre? One credit, 1 acre?
That's a good question, and there really are a variety of ways to approach it. For many banks, the particular bank instrument has fallen back on a series of acreage-based credit determinations. So if you've got a 1,000-acre bank, it could yield 1,000-acre credits, and then those credits are doled out at certain ratios depending on the quality of the resource that you're impacting. Many other banks, as one of the slides in my PowerPoint noted, choose to use various assessment tools to try and quantify the environmental benefits that are likely to take place at the bank site using a variety of science-based, more rapid assessment tools. So there really is a variety of ways to try and quantify potential credits at a bank, from the coarse acreage-based crediting to the more sophisticated approaches using quasi-rapid science-based assessment tools.
Are there any other questions? Okay, if there are no further questions, we'll proceed with our presentation. And at this time, Jessica, I'd like you to take it away. Jessica, could you please unmute yourself at this time?
Megan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, sorry.
Thanks.
Thank you all for joining us today, and thank you, Palmer, for a great introduction to the 404 program and compensatory mitigation. Also for the flattering remarks about my photo, but in the interest of full disclosure, I think that's about a 10-year-old photo. I'd also like to thank EPA for hosting this call and my colleague Rebecca Kisslinger for putting it together. Unfortunately, she had a nasty case of laryngitis and was unable to join us today. As Megan noted, I direct ELI's wetlands program, and ELI has an extensive background in wetland policy and a particular focus on compensatory mitigation, and a lot of the resources that we have put together are available through the additional resources link on the main page for this seminar. As Palmer mentioned, this seminar is a very abbreviated version of a 2-day training course which ELI designed with EPA and the Center for Natural Lands Management. The course is being delivered around the country to interested land trusts, and the goal of it is to improve the capacity of land trusts to take on the long-term stewardship of wetland mitigation sites in perpetuity, as well as to meet the requirements of the Clean Water 404 program. Land trusts and watershed groups have a wealth of experience in preserving land and managing land. These groups are truly the nation's stewardship professionals and set the standard for excellence in the field of land stewardship. They also have a deep contact with local community and landowners and are often in a good position to provide the long-term protection for wetlands compensation sites. On the plus side, becoming involved in mitigation projects can provide land trusts with opportunities to add land to their portfolio of protected areas in their target areas. And because stewardship endowments are often part of the agreement for taking on the long-term stewardship responsibilities of a compensation project, playing this role may also have served to increase the financial and professional capacity of the organization. But on the flip side, stewardship of mitigation sites is not as straightforward as that for other land protection projects. Because the wetlands being protected are associated with a regulatory program, it is important to have a firm grasp of these regulatory issues, as well as an understanding of how a mitigation project might fit in with the overall goals of the organization. Understanding the different roles that a land trust can play in mitigation and having an understanding of where you are coming into the mitigation process will dictate your level of responsibility as well as your fiscal and legal liability. On slide 37, today I will talk about the roles a conservation organization can play in compensatory mitigation. The presentation will focus primarily on the role of long-term steward. I will also introduce some of the basic tools that each organization should have for evaluating whether to engage in a given mitigation project, and if so, under what terms. Regardless of the role a land trust plays, land trust should review the mitigation plan and associated documents before taking on any project. Today, I will briefly review the key elements that Palmer mentioned that all land trusts should pay close attention to as they review the plan. And I'll finish up my presentation by going through a list of things that all conservation organizations should consider before entering a mitigation project. On slide 38, land trusts can play a variety of roles in the federal wetland program. Land trusts can opt to sponsor a wetland mitigation bank or in lieu fee program. They can enter into an agreement to be a partner in a mitigation project. Land trust may agree to accept an easement on or title to a property on which a compensatory mitigation project has been carried out, whether that is a permitted responsible project, a mitigation bank, or an in lieu fee mitigation, and thereby become the long-term steward of the site. Or land trust may enter into some creative combination of the above. Regardless of what role a land trust chooses to play, it is critical to evaluate in advance whether the project fits into the organization's mission statement and does not exceed the comfort level of the organization's board of directors or the group's technical expertise. Finally, the group must weigh the opportunities and potential liabilities that come with involvement in compensatory mitigation projects. I'm now going to review these different roles, program sponsor, project partner, and long-term stewardship in more detail. Again, I also want to remind you that the focus of this webcast and 3-day training course, or 2-day training course, is primarily on the third role, that of long-term steward. On slide 39, so that first category, a land trust or conservation organization may opt to become a mitigation provider. In this case, land trusts can either sponsor a mitigation bank or sponsor an in-lieu fee program. Under such arrangements, the land trust works with the relevant state and federal agencies to secure approval of the bank or in-lieu fee program, enters into an agreement with those agencies, secures ownership of a site or sites, carries out the on-the-ground mitigation activities, and assumes full liability for meeting the bank or site's performance standards. And I'll give you an example of land trusts that have sponsored both a wetland mitigation bank and an in-lieu fee program. On the next slide, number 40, as Palmer mentioned, almost 60% of the nation's 42 approved in-lieu fee programs are sponsored by private nonprofit organizations, many of which are land trusts. So land trusts play a very large role in the in-lieu fee world. Land trust sponsoring in-lieu fee programs may use the fees collected to acquire and restore wetlands in areas that are a geographic priority or under significant threat of development. As an example, the Great Land Trust in Alaska entered into an in-lieu fee agreement with the Army Corps in 1998. Since the program's inception, the trust has collected approximately $3 million in mitigation fees. So they accept fees as permits are issued and then hold those fees until they have the funds to carry out the mitigation project. The trust has used the funds primarily to support large wetland restoration and preservation projects in an area that is both under severe development pressure and in the trust's target areas of interest. On the next slide, slide number 41, is an example of a land trust involved in a wetland mitigation bank. As Palmer pointed out, about 5% of all wetland mitigation banks are sponsored by nonprofit conservation organizations, some of which are land trusts. For example, the Nature Conservancy has sponsored a number of banks, primarily in the Southeast. Land trusts play a fairly minor role in the wetland mitigation banking world, in contrast to in-lieu fee. As one example, in November 96, the Nature Conservancy's Mississippi chapter acquired a 1,700-acre converted loblolly pine commercial forest to establish the Old Fort Bayou Mitigation Bank. The restored wetland site now features several habitat types, including pine savanna, bottomland hardwood, and emergent marsh. In addition to this bank, TNC Mississippi also is a sponsor of the Red Creek Consolidated Mitigation Project. Together, TNC's wetland and stream mitigation banking efforts have helped preserve and maintain important aquatic resources in South Mississippi. The Great Land Trust and TNC Mississippi examples may seem enticing, and they have generated at least in projects such as these, have generated, at least in some cases, significant sources of income to land trusts and have allowed them to preserve and manage priority lands. Sponsoring compensatory mitigation projects, being the sponsor of a bank or an in-lieu fee project, however, carries with it significant liabilities, not to mention significant time, staff, and other resource investments that must be devoted to the process, which is pretty involved, and these projects should be carefully evaluated. And Deborah is going to talk about some of these liabilities in greater detail after my presentation. Slide number 42, I already talked about the role of land trust as a project sponsor. The second role that a land trust can play is a project partner. Land trusts can partner with an in-lieu fee sponsor or other mitigation provider. In these cases, a land trust may agree to perform restoration work or assume a permittee's required monitoring responsibilities. The responsibilities and liabilities taken on by the project partner can vary widely with the site and the specific mitigation requirements. Partnering on a mitigation project can give land trust leverage in guiding site selection and directing the restoration activities, which can ultimately influence the success of the site itself. However, depending on the terms of the agreement, being a partner in a mitigation project can carry with it liabilities as well. Before agreeing to partner on a mitigation project, the land trust should detail all of their restoration or management responsibilities in a formal management agreement with the mitigation provider and any of the regulatory agencies that play a role. On slide number 43, I have an example of a land trust that has partnered with mitigation providers on a number of mitigation projects. This is the Solano Land Trust in California. The trust has primarily supported planning and implementing habitat restoration projects on their own properties. The land trust also holds conservation easements on other project sites and has accepted title and management obligations in perpetuity. The Solano Land Trust has received a number of requests from project proponents and decided to develop a set of procedures to guide all future mitigation requests. they pulled these procedures into a document called Mitigation Program of the SLAN Land Trust. It lays out the criteria that the Land Trust uses to define acceptable projects, as well as a three-step process to guide staff through the mitigation process. Excuse me. You can access and review that document through the trust website, which is SlanoLandTrust.org. Finally, the third role that I will cover that a land trust can play in stewardship of mitigation sites is the long-term stewardship responsibilities of a wetland mitigation project. And again, this is really the focus of this presentation as well as the course that we offer. The long-term steward of a wetland compensatory mitigation site is the entity that assumes control over and legal responsibility for a mitigation site after the ecological performance standards and administrative requirements have been met and after the Corps has certified that the project is in compliance. The steward is accountable for implementing all of the long-term management responsibilities identified in the mitigation site's long-term management plan. So there's an active part of a mitigation project during which time the project sponsor is responsible for monitoring and carrying out responsibilities, and then there's a long-term phase, and this is when the land trust comes in as a long-term steward is coming in after all the credits have sold or after the project has met all its compliance requirements and just takes on the long-term stewardship role. That's that third role and the focus of the rest of this presentation. On the next slide, number 45, stewardship responsibilities can vary significantly, but can include monitoring the site, carrying out long-term maintenance requirements, and monitoring easements. In some cases, particularly when a project does not require much of any ongoing restoration or management responsibilities, playing the role of a long-term steward can be similar to that required of a donated easement. However, mitigation projects often require a land trust to assume responsibilities that go above and beyond those required of traditional easements. And because most mitigation sites have been restored or enhanced to some degree, they may require more intensive long-term management, such as fire management or invasive species control, than typical easements require. The long-term management plan may also define specific monitoring and reporting schedules that are required of the site steward in perpetuity. Slide number 46 is an example. The Congaree Land Trust in South Carolina became involved with the long-term stewardship of wetland mitigation sites when a local family asked the organization to hold an easement on one of their properties that included a mitigation site. Congaree currently holds 9 easements on properties that include wetland compensation sites. These include both project-specific mitigation and wetland mitigation bank sites. Congaree continues to explore opportunities for taking on the long-term stewardship of mitigation sites by working with local landowners and agencies. The next slide, slide 47. The different roles that a land trust can play in compensatory mitigation may differ by mitigation mechanism. Here, this slide lists the different roles broken out by the type of compensatory mitigation. Compensation mechanism. So the first mechanism, permittee responsible mitigation, the primary role the land trust might play is taking on the long-term stewardship of the site. And again, permittee responsible mitigation can be carried out on-site or off-site, on the site where the impact occurred or on a site some distance from where the impact occurred. In the realm of wetland mitigation banking, a land trust can be the long-term steward of a wetland mitigation bank site or can sponsor a bank. And then finally, in in-lieu fee mitigation, a land trust can be the long-term steward of an in-lieu fee site, sponsor an in-lieu fee program, or just sponsor an in-lieu fee project. The next slide, slide 48, Palmer spent a bit of time reviewing the process by which permits are approved, mitigation is required, and mitigation projects are themselves reviewed, approved, and carried out. And I made a distinction between the active phase of a mitigation project, when the project sponsor is required to actively monitor the site, and the long-term management stage of a project, when the mitigation requirements have been met and a long-term steward takes over the long-term responsibilities associated with the site. The point at which land trusts become involved in a project will ultimately influence the responsibilities that a land trust will assume, whether and to what degree the land trust can guide site selection and mitigation plan design, and the level of liability to which the group is exposed. I'm now going to review several possible points of entry or points at which a land trust can enter into negotiations in a project and highlight how this will affect a group's influence on the project. The earliest possible point of involvement is during the permit process. Getting involved in a prospective project at this point can help ensure that the land trust plays a significant role in project design, which in turn will increase the likelihood that the project will meet the organization's protection priorities. During the permit process, a consultant, engineer, agency, or landowner may ask a land trust to sign on as a long-term steward. The land trust may have an opportunity to comment on or assist with design of compensation site and comment on the terms of the long-term management plan. Many land trusts have in-house expertise available to help develop management plans, and this is a real area of expertise for land trusts, and so often an appropriate role. Land trusts can provide project applicants with mitigation opportunities on land they own in fee, in which case the land trust may carry out the mitigation activities themselves or may hire a consultant to do so. Land trusts may identify and negotiate with willing landowners in advance of permittees identified mitigation needs. In such cases, when the organization is contacted by the permitting agency or the permittee, they may already have a mitigation site and willing landowner lined up. And finally, land trusts can sponsor a mitigation banker in the fee program. On the next slide, 49, alternatively, the land trust may get involved during the process of construction of the mitigation compensation project or during the active monitoring period. In such cases, the land trust may assume restoration or monitoring responsibilities or may partner with an in-lieu fee program sponsor to take on an in-lieu fee project. However, most land trust involvement with compensatory mitigation is likely to be limited to playing the role of long-term steward. This role plays well to the professional expertise of land trusts, but still carries with it far more responsibility than accepting Title II or a conservation easement on a property. Assuming the long-term stewardship of a mitigation site will entail taking on all the responsibilities identified in the long-term management plan. The next slide, number 50. Before playing any of these roles, though, a land trust should carefully review the mitigation documents, including the mitigation plan. Although the structure and content of mitigation plans likely varies by core district, the permittee or project sponsor is responsible for complying with all the terms and conditions of the plan and would be in violation of the permit if the mitigation fails to comply with the plan. Slide number 51. This is a kind of a duplicate of the slide that Palmer showed that had certain asterisks after certain elements. As he mentioned, the key elements for land trust to scrutinize in reviewing a mitigation plan, and particularly here I'm thinking about the role of the long-term steward, are the site protection instrument, the maintenance plan, the monitoring requirement, the long-term management plan, the contingency plans, if they're available, and the financial assurances. And I will review each of these sections in turn. On slide 52, site protection. This section on site protection lays out the type of real estate provisions. The section of the mitigation plan on site protection lays out the type of real estate provision that will be used to protect the land in perpetuity, whether it's a title transfer, conservation easement, a deed restriction, or a declaration of restrictions. This section of the mitigation plan should also identify the entity to whom the real estate provision will be transferred. So whether it will be transferred to a land trust or another party, and ideally it would include the date or milestone for that transfer. The land trust may be identified in the permit as the holder of the long-term easement or other real estate instrument. The next slide is on the maintenance and monitoring section of the mitigation plan. Again, very critical to land trusts. This section may outline long-term responsibilities, such as maintaining water control structures, long-term sediment removal, or fire management, things that may be required in perpetuity for a given site. This section should also include maintenance provisions that are the long-term responsibilities that may transfer to the long-term steward. Maintenance tasks may include invasive species control, prevention of grazing, or habitat restoration. And monitoring provisions. These may stipulate the responsible parties and their roles, the data that must be collected, assessment tools used to monitor progress towards performance standards, and the reporting format, frequency, recipients, and schedule. On the next slide, long-term management plan. This section is especially critical for land trusts because these are the long-term stewardship responsibilities for which the steward will be held responsible. This section should also specify the entity that will take over long-term management responsibilities from the provider, the source of the long-term endowment, which Palmer touched on, and the time frame for long-term management activities. Depending on when the land trust gets involved in the project, the organization may be afforded the opportunity to comment on or help draft the long-term management plan. On the next page, the next slide, number 55, long-term management. The land trust should also entertain the idea of drafting their own long-term management plan for each mitigation site, which would lay out all of their responsibilities and the schedule for conducting these. All the relevant mitigation documents should be reviewed thoroughly to assess the terms of the real estate instruments employed, the extent of the trust management responsibilities, and the group's financial and legal liabilities. This document that's used here as an example was prepared by the Center for Natural Lands Management and incorporates all of these responsibilities from both the federal permit and the state permits required for the project. In addition, before agreeing to play a role in any mitigation project, land trusts should formally lay the responsibilities and endowment expectations in a long-term stewardship or management and funding agreement. The mitigation provider, regulatory agencies, and the land trust should sign the agreement. Finally, the land trust should build an effective system to track all of its mitigation responsibilities and deferred mitigation expenses. On the next slide, number 56, contingency plans. This is another section of the mitigation plan that is crucial to review. It should include provisions for responding to unanticipated site conditions or changes. If, for example, the site is not in compliance with the terms of its permit or mitigation agreement, the section will lay out who is responsible and how remedial measures will be funded. The next slide, financial assurances. Financial assurances come in two distinct flavors and come into play at different stages of mitigation projects. The first, contingency funds, are generally required during the active phase of the mitigation project and typically last until either the end of the monitoring period or after all the credits have been sold. Contingency funds may be up to 10% of the annual operating budget to ensure that the project gets completed and meets its performance standards. The second type of financial assurance is a long-term management fund, which is required after the monitoring period is over or after the mitigation bank's credits have been sold to ensure that the property can be adequately managed in perpetuity. Next slide, number 58. Again, the mitigation provider and the easement holder should establish an agreement that includes and identifies a financial assurance mechanism, financial entity that will manage the funds, date or milestone for the transfer of funds, schedule by which financial assurances may be reviewed, and limitations on how the funds can be spent before a land trust agrees to take on the site. Slide 59. As I mentioned earlier, those key components of mitigation plan may be tough to lay your hands on, and because the format of these mitigation plans may vary significantly from core district to core district, navigating the labyrinth of regulatory permits and plans can be overwhelming. So here we try and lay out, give you some tips on where you find these key elements. In the case of permanently responsible mitigation sites, these key elements should generally be able to be located in the permit itself, included as a mitigation plan attached to the permit or in a mitigation plan yet to be submitted. But if that's the case, it should be referenced in the permit. So the first place to go to identify what responsibilities you have are to the permit itself in the case of permanently responsible mitigation. For a wetland mitigation bank, the key elements can be found in the mitigation banking agreement, mitigation banking instrument, in other words, which includes a detailed mitigation plan. And for in-lieu fee sites, the key elements can be found in the in-lieu fee agreement, which is between the sponsor and generally the core, but can also be found in the specific in-lieu fee project plan or proposal that is drafted each time the sponsor uses in-lieu fee funds to carry out a mitigation project. It is important, again, to note that mitigation plans differ significantly from core district to core district and from project to project. It's therefore very important that the land trust knows who to ask for information and what information to ask for. The district court office is the place to start for tracking down this information. Things to consider. Having said that, this is slide number 60, having said that there are a few things that each land trust can consider internally before jumping into a mitigation program. There are questions to ask of yourself before getting involved. Organizational stability. How long has the organization been around? Does it have the capacity to take on mitigation projects? Mission. Does the project fit in with the mission of the organization? And does it have the support of the board of directors? Financial soundness. What is the source of funding, investment, policy? Do you have a savvy board? Audited statements are public record. So it's important to have the capacity to calculate the stewardship costs and track the responsibilities and money. Ability to perform. Does the organization have the staff to implement the project and the ability to hold and manage mitigation lands? Staff capabilities and credentials. Does your group have the professional credentialed experience and expertise to take on these projects? On the next slide, 61, additional things to consider. Political leanings and involvement. Is the land trust prepared for any potential litigation? Will it be viewed as facilitating development? These are some big issues that many land trusts struggle with when deciding whether and the degree to which to become involved in compensatory mitigation. And finally, professionalism. How is the land trust viewed by the community and its members? With all of these considerations in mind, and with adequate preparation, land trusts can be uniquely qualified to take on the long-term stewardship responsibilities of wetland mitigation sites. Land trust involvement in long-term stewardship of compensation sites will not only assist the federal resource agencies in improving the long-term success of compensation projects, but may also provide land trusts with unique conservation opportunities and additional sources of funding with which to pursue their land preservation missions. However, each land trust should carefully consider all of the opportunities and liabilities associated with mitigation before taking on the long-term stewardship responsibilities of a mitigation site. And with that, I'll take some questions.
Okay, if everyone could please advance to slide 63, and thank you, Jessica. Sorry, 62. That's slide number 62 we're on right now. We'll break for some questions. And remember that you can submit questions at any time online by clicking on the question mark button at the top of the slides page. Again, we'll begin with some online questions. And our first question comes from Anne in Maryland, and she asks, what issues should a small volunteer-organized land trust think about before getting involved with compensatory mitigation?
Well, the first question is whether or not it meets your mission and your goals. Some of those issues I outlined on the last slides. But you also need to evaluate the role you're going to play and at what point you're going to become involved in mitigation. And Deborah's presentation, which will follow, is going to cover a lot more about the long-term stewardship endowment and how to ensure that if you do become involved, you have the financial resources to ensure that you can manage this property in perpetuity responsibly and without it becoming an economic drain on your organization.
Our next question comes from Susan in Virginia, who asks, who pays for the long-term stewardship fund for a compensation site?
Very good question and very critical. And Deborah is going to cover that as well. But in the case of becoming a long-term stewardship for a mitigation site, it should be the mitigation provider. They want to pass on the long-term responsibilities for the site because, generally speaking, they're not stewardship professionals. They're folks who got a permit to construct some kind of either residence or commercial or development, and it's their preference to not have the responsibilities associated with that site. And in passing it on to a land trust, it's fully expected that they should support the expenses related to that. And Deborah's going to talk more about how to calculate that and the importance of asking for an adequate stewardship endowment.
Great. We'll take one more question from those submitted online. And Carrie from Los Angeles would like to know, why, in your opinion, is the in-lieu fee program on the decline?
I mean, it's not been on the decline in terms of the number of in-lieu fee programs. The proposed rule that Palmer mentioned proposed to eliminate in-lieu fee as a mitigation option. However, it's not been finalized yet, so it's unclear. So it hasn't been on the decline as a tool, but depending on what the final rule says, will dictate obviously its future.
Great. And at this time, if anyone would like to ask a question over the phone, please unmute yourself and give us your name and organization before your question. Please mute your phone if you do not have a question, and if you do have a question, please speak up and give us your name and organization. Okay, if there are no further questions, could you please advance your slides to slide number 63? Again, that's 63. And at this time, again, if you did unmute yourself, please be sure that you have muted yourself. Before we get into the third and final section of today's presentation, I'd like to take a moment to let you know about our June 21st webcast on STORET, that's EPA's Storage and Retrieval Database. Please visit the Watershed Academy webcast webpage at www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts for more information. Okay, Deborah, take it away.
Good morning, Megan. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Thanks so much. And, Megan, we didn't discuss amongst ourselves the contingency plan for what happens if we're ahead of schedule. Should I assume I don't need to be as concise? Or maybe it would be more fair to allow more time for questions.
Yeah, that might be worth it.
Okay, good. Well, like Jessica, I want to express my thanks to the EPA for organizing this national seminar, and also my appreciation to my colleagues on this webcast, Jessica, Rebecca, and Palmer, because I've certainly learned a great deal about wetland mitigation from them. So good morning to my colleagues out here in the West, and good afternoon to the rest of you. And please join me now on slide 64. So the challenge of conservation is that it's never done. A project to conserve or preserve, once started, outlives our individual lifetimes, as well as the lifetimes most likely of even the organizations that we represent. So how can we be responsible and effective stewards in this context of infinity and all of the uncertainty it represents? And please join me on slide 65. Well, the presentation goals for my part of this webcast certainly don't include answering that question, but I can offer some perspectives from an organization that was inspired by that challenge and that has 17 years of testing an approach towards financial planning for stewardship in perpetuity. The information and the experience that I can share with you comes largely from the founding executive director of this organization, Sherry Teresa, and so this information does have the validity of a practitioner's perspective. I'm going to emphasize also the importance of sound financial planning to science-based stewardship, and also near the end offer some trends that I think are true that reflect influences on nature preserves that are very critical to address now at the planning stage and to include in the financial plan. Moving on to slide 66, this organization that I mentioned with 17 years of stewardship practice is the Center for Natural Lands Management. It's a dynamic, rapidly growing nonprofit organization. In fact, it's so dynamic and rapidly growing that this slide is obsolete, as I just prepared it last week. I'm informed today by our director of administration that we now have approximately 65 preserves, not 60 that I've listed there, and well over 50,000 acres that we're managing now in the state of California. So this organization was founded in 1990. These bullets that you see on slide 66 are not meant to be a comprehensive representation of the organization. There's more information about it on our website. And I'll also refer to us as the Center instead of Center for Natural Lands Management in the rest of this presentation. But I do want to give you a sense of its organization, its size, the diversity of habitats that we manage, and the financial stature so that each of you have some context and means by which to weigh the value of the Center's stewardship experience and to compare it with your own organizations. So you can see I've listed here some of the types of habitats we manage. So in the context of wetlands, we have various descriptions, vernal pools, freshwater marshes, seasonal wetlands, riparian areas, palm oases, as well as many dry lands. As mentioned, we now manage well over 50,000 acres each preserve. They vary widely in their size. And in addition to now having 65 preserves within our purview, there are usually 20 to 30 preserves somewhere in the pipeline. We currently manage preserves only in the state of California, but expansion to other states is a topic of serious consideration. We typically have three basic types of relationship to the preserves. We can own them outright. Second, manage them under contract in perpetuity. Or third, sometimes we just hold a conservation easement over them. And in case it's confusing, I want to mention that I'll probably use the terms preserve or property interchangeably. And if it's more comfortable, you can insert the term mitigation site. And please now join me on slide 67. As I alluded earlier, this organization, the Center, was founded on the principle that sound mechanisms are needed for funding stewardship in perpetuity. And the corollary to this is that we need a means by which to calculate and thereby justify the funding that is required. The Center stewardship model is, like many other that of many other environmental organizations, firmly grounded in science-based stewardship, and it's fueled by conservation passion. But the strength and perhaps most significant contribution to the broader community of environmental stewards is its attention to due diligence and financial planning before acquiring a preserve. So simply put, know what you are getting and know what it's going to cost before committing to the relationship. That's probably good advice for any kind of relationship. Due diligence means not only assessing the biological status of the site, but understanding the regulatory requirements pertaining to any listed species, determining the legal status and any restrictions on the property, determining any cultural significance, land use on neighboring properties, and of course, understanding the hydrology of the site. And all of that due diligence has also been emphasized by Jessica. So after collecting this information, a comprehensive financial plan is developed called the Property Analysis Record, and I'll mention more about that soon. And just a little bit more about the stewardship model on slide 68. So that financial plan then typically leads towards the development of a stewardship fund. And now we come to another principle that the Center holds to be critical. Even though funds from all our preserves are pooled for investment purposes, every preserve is managed using only the funds that come from the income from its own original stewardship fund. Our accounting system maintains separate budgets and records for each preserve. And there is an annual audit conducted by an independent firm. The other elements of the Center's stewardship model, as shown here, are those that are probably shared with many other preserve managing organizations. We do prepare our own management plans regardless of the documents we may inherit when we assume management responsibilities. And we do engage, where appropriate and possible, members of the research community to encourage valuable research on site or to consult with them about our management activities. Slide 69. The ability to do good science-based stewardship depends on having the financial resources sufficient to the task. Protecting a preserve, even if there is no restoration involved or anticipated, requires more than acquisition and fencing because of the continual challenges to the site, both natural and human-influenced. The type of stewardship activities and the attendant costs are driven by the management objectives. So the financial plan begins with a clear statement of the management objectives. Slide 70. So how do we go about translating management or stewardship objectives into a financial plan? We approach this by considering that to reach our stewardship objectives requires three basic topics. First of all, funding the infrastructure, that is the buildings, the staff, their continued professional development, all required kinds of organizational support. Secondly, of course, the specific tasks or activities associated with stewardship. And third, dealing with the uncertainty of the future. Biological uncertainties for sure, but also financial or market, societal, and legal uncertainties. And all of these considerations should go into the financial plan. Slide 71. The center has created a software program, the Property Analysis Record, or PAR, to support this financial analysis. It's a standalone software program based on the FoxPro database. This program serves the financial model of calculating a non-wasting endowment, earned income from which will provide the annual operating budget for each preserve. As input to that software program, due diligence is required of the biological, physical, and cultural characteristics of the preserve, as well as its legal status, such as ownership and any existing conservation easements. I think all of us have very much emphasized the point of due diligence, and that's because all of us in this organization, after 17 years of experience, we're still learning and attending to that lesson. That is just critical. Then each stewardship activity or task is identified, and the cost for each task is entered into the program. And then finally, we need to supply the program with financial parameters. So you choose these. For example, the interest rate that you believe the investment will earn, the rate of inflation, and the cost of funds administration. So that's what's required of you as input to this software tool. Then the output from the PAR. Well, first of all, of course, you get the amount of funding needed to provide the annual revenue for preserve management. In other words, the required endowment. But because you've now gone through an exercise of identifying all the stewardship tasks, you've also developed a very good outline for your management plan. And then because of that same exercise, you also now have been provided with the justification for the funding requirements. Slide 72. So the first step is a planning exercise. The management objectives are parsed into stewardship activities, which in the PAR program can be covered under one of the 12 headings you see here. You might well have different headings. For example, provision and maintenance of signs or trail development, if public access is going to be permitted on the site, would be considered in this program as public services. Monitoring of endangered or threatened species that may be required by a regulatory agency is included under biotic surveys. Costs for maintaining pumps, wells, ditches, and other management structures are included here. Both their maintenance and their longer-term replacement costs. Slide 73. In addition to the costs associated with each stewardship activity and the infrastructure costs, Some funds are also included to cover services and conditions that can be anticipated over the lifetime of the preserve, and that is in perpetuity. So these funds include legal services, adaptive management, contingencies, and research and development. Slide 74. So after all the management activities, which are again driven by the management objectives, have been defined, you can then associate each activity with both a cost and a time frame. And you determine those, although there are some built-in options in the PAR software. In the center's financial planning processes, costs are separated into two temporal categories. First one being the initial and capital costs, and the second one, ongoing costs. Generally, tasks identified in the initial and capital costs will occur only during the first year or for the first several years. For example, and I've listed some of them here, purchasing and installing the first fence, creating your first management plan, those kinds of activities. Slide 75. The second category, the ongoing tasks, are those that will occur in perpetuity. Monitoring, for example, could occur, be required to occur in perpetuity. Certainly fence repair will be. So for those ongoing costs, you need to identify their frequency. That is, will it be every year, every 5 years, every 40 years? And then what you do is allow sufficient funding annually so that funding can accumulate over time to pay for those large, although infrequent, expenses such as fence replacement. It's very important to separate the initial and capital costs from the ongoing costs for two reasons. First of all, because the initial and capital costs are generally higher than average ongoing costs. And secondly, because endowments do not generate sufficient income in the first year of their investment to pay for initial and capital costs. Slide 76. Financial parameters. Recall that the center's financial model is one of establishing an endowment with the expectation that earned income from that endowment will fund stewardship in perpetuity. So in addition to the cost of infrastructure and stewardship activities, it's very important to factor in the financial realities of stewardship in perpetuity when estimating the required endowment. If we don't, our projected costs will not be covered by the investment earnings. So by financial parameters, what I mean are the level of income that you can expect from the endowment over time. Secondly, the administrative cost of managing the endowment. And third, the expected inflation rate. And those three parameters are reflected in one rate that I've described here, the capitalization rate. So as an example, say your investment is earning, or you estimate that your investment is going to be able to earn 10%. Let's say that the cost of inflation is 4% and the cost of managing the money is about 1%. So simple math tells you that that leaves you 5% of your capital investment each year for stewardship costs. So that 5% is the capitalization rate. And, of course, there are annual fluctuations in all of these rates. At the center, we use a 40-year history of inflation and investment returns to calculate our rates. And still on that slide, as an example of how the capitalization rate influences the endowment that will be needed, let's assume that you decided that you need an annual operating budget of $10,000 to manage your site. And you've decided that your capitalization rate is 4.5%. What that means then is that you need to have a preserve endowment of over $200,000 in order to reliably generate your annual operating budget. Slide 77. it's important to have a very well-reasoned capitalization rate because its impact on the endowment is profound. Let's consider four different capitalization rates here. They probably span the realistic range of that rate. With a constant annual budget of $20,000, I hope for obvious reasons, and you can see here, the higher the capitalization rate, the smaller the endowment needs to be. So it's really important to consult your financial advisors before choosing an appropriate capitalization rate for an endowment. It's just a single number, but it's one that can greatly alter your capacity to care for the habitats over time. Slide 78. We can't do much about inflation, and the cost of managing the endowment probably doesn't vary very much. So the biggest variable in the capitalization rate is the interest. So let's contrast two examples that vary in interest rate. So this slide shows the first example. Both examples will begin with an endowment of $400,000. In this first example on slide 78, a nonprofit organization such as a land trust has the freedom to determine its investment strategy, probably a balanced portfolio. And let's say that your investment could earn on an average 8.5% interest. And let's further assume that inflation and funds administration cost 4%. So that leaves 4.5% to manage the preserve, and that means that we get an annual budget of $18,000 for that preserve. So keep that number in mind. You have an annual operating budget of $18,000 for your mitigation site. And let's take a look at the second example on slide 79. So in the second example, we again start with an endowment of $400,000, but this time the fund is managed by a government entity. Most government agencies receive significantly lower returns because, as I'm told, they can legally invest only in bonds. So in this case, we've assumed that they can have an income of 6.2%. We've used the same inflation rate and the same funds administration rate as the first example. But the difference here, the capitalization rate, is only 2.2%. So that's going to yield an annual budget of only $10,000. So that's about half of the previous example. Slide 80. Some concluding comments about the PAR. First of all, I want to just emphasize that it's only a tool. It doesn't make decisions or determine the management objectives. It requires good research and well-reasoned input costs to yield a reasonable result. It is helpful in facilitating communication. As you know better than I, land conservation brings together some very disparate interests, that's disparate, not desperate, in development, conservation, and regulation. And these different interests come with different values and different institutional cultures and different languages. But money is the common denominator that's usually understood. So using a tool such as the PAR helps translate those different interests and those management objectives into a common language, that is money. And finally, every preserve is unique. So we do need a flexible financial management tool, and the PAR is flexible. It will accommodate different management objectives, different kinds of habitats and locations, and legal relationships to the site, different management constraints. So that's important. We should be careful about overgeneralizing about planning for preserve stewardship. Every site is unique. Slide 81. I want to show you a couple of our wetland mitigation preserves. These are in Northern California, and in response to the question that Morgan was asking Palmer, I think the two examples that I'm going to show here maybe come from different contexts. I suppose the first one you could consider to be urban or suburban. It's very close to a city. And the second one is probably suburban or quasi-rural, or you can make that determination once I explain to you the context of that second preserve example. So on this site, I wanted to share with you a little bit of information about our Peace Preserve. It's located near Stockton, California, and it's a 50-acre created wetland with a diversity of habitats, mainly for waterfowl. Water levels are managed manually with a siphon that diverts water from the San Joaquin River into ditches. Key activities and expenses for this preserve are maintenance of the siphon and clearing of the drainage ditches and outlet structure and keeping one step ahead of the beavers. Slide 82. Our Pritchard Lake Preserve is still in the pipeline, so to speak. So I'm being optimistic in sharing this one with you, but it's so close, I think it's fine to share with you a little bit about this newest preserve. It's located near the Sacramento International Airport, which no doubt some of you have visited and may even be familiar with this area. It's a combination of restored and created habitat, both wetlands and some upland areas, the latter being important habitat for the threatened giant garter snake. Here the challenge is not only to maintain good quality habitat for the garter snake and wetland species, but to decrease the potential for aircraft wildlife strikes. So some very serious responsibilities on that preserve. Slide 83. I'd like to conclude with some, you can call them principles or trends and truths, that have a strong bearing on our stewardship responsibilities and on the cost of management in perpetuity. These principles don't easily resolve into individual stewardship tasks or infrastructure implications or financial parameters, but they are principles that should be considered when doing a cost analysis of a mitigation site. So the first principle is that as the distance or difference of a preserve from a natural condition increases, the cost of managing that preserve will increase. Created sites are much riskier and more challenging in general and more expensive than natural areas that have been preserved. And as has been mentioned, I believe it was Palmer that gave the breakdown from that 2006 report, which showed that at that time about 85% of the mitigation sites were created, enhanced, or restored. So only about 15% of them are so-called natural areas that have been preserved. So we need to use, when we're thinking about stewardship tasks, we need to use a sense of sort of elevated risk or uncertainty, because enhancement, restoration, and creation to a certain extent has an experimental nature to it. The second principle, stewardship costs on a per area basis increase as preserve size decreases. And part of that is because of economy of scale and the effect of there being some fixed costs. But in part, it's also for biological reasons, or the so-called edge effects. For example, assuming that the lands adjacent to the preserve have a different land use, such as a housing development, agricultural field, or golf course, then conditions along the preserve perimeter will be transitional from one land use to the other, unless there's a good buffer area. And this transitional area, which is presumably part of your preserve or site, may require greater effort to maintain than the core preserve areas. For example, adjacent lands may be a source of new invasions of exotic invasive plant species. The perimeter of the preserve may experience drift from chemical herbicide spraying on adjacent lands, or may be additional points of undesirable entry by the public to the preserve. So as the ratio of perimeter to core increases, so do the challenges and presumably the costs. Slide 84 shows the third principle. This, I believe, is fairly well established, that there will be increasing pressures for recreation over time on the preserve. As the amount of land available for recreation decreases, generally due to development of land for other purposes, we can expect an increase in prohibited activities on our preserves. This is perhaps even more likely on preserves that are close to urban areas. So it's important to consider the cost for protecting a preserve may increase over time. This particular example that I've shown is one that's very pertinent to many of our preserves in Southern California, and we recently obtained some quantification of that increasing recreation pressure from the California Biodiversity Council. And I do recognize that that particular form of recreation may not be so pertinent to wetland areas, but you can substitute your own preferred or most likely recreation for that one. Slide 85. In addition to experiencing increased pressure for recreation, we can also reasonably expect that preserves will assume the roles of refugia for species that are displaced by land conversion. So species composition on our preserves may change over time, and that requires some consideration in the management plan and thus costs. Secondly, for those instances where endangered species, and they could be plant or animal, are removed from development sites, our preserves may increasingly be sought as translocation sites for reintroducing those species. And some of our sites have received requests for such reintroduction. So there are costs associated in risk assessment and in managing for those changes. Finally, and for the same reasons as the other pressures, that is, continued conversion of natural areas into other land uses, there may be increased requests from the research community for access to the preserves to conduct research on natural processes and species. Now, in many cases, of course, that research is desirable, and it's an asset to our management capabilities, but it's not free to the preserve manager. That is, time is required to consider the research impact, to explain the site values and conditions to the researcher, and probably to negotiate an agreement for such access. So that concludes a quick overview of this organization's approach to calculating long-term management costs for mitigation wetlands or other habitat sites. If you'd like to learn more about the specific preserves that have been pictured in this presentation, or to learn more about the organization, please do visit our website. And as Megan mentioned, our email addresses are all provided on the introductory information to this webcast, and I'd certainly be happy to accept questions by email as well. So back to you, Megan.
Thank you, Deborah. We do have time to answer some additional questions. However, first, please move on to slide 87. And again, let me draw your attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you are online, simply click on the Home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the seminar's homepage, which has today's speakers' email addresses and phone numbers. On the left-hand sidebar is the Link button, which has additional resources identified by today's speakers. Also on the left-hand sidebar is the Feedback button. Please take a quick minute or so to submit the online feedback form, as we really do consider your comments in our quest to improve our webcast. Both the additional resources page as well as our online feedback form can also be accessed via the same website where you registered for today's webcast. Now we do have some time for questions, and let's begin with those submitted online. Our first question comes from Roy in Gulfport, Florida, and he would like to know, the Environmental Trust, a nonprofit land trust in California, filed for bankruptcy and has or is in the process of liquidation. What is happening to the sites for which TET had long-term stewardship responsibilities?
Great question, and there are other staff in my organization who can speak more eloquently to that. But I don't mean to sidestep your question completely, Roy. I just mean to the extent that I can't address specifics and you might be interested in more specifics, don't hesitate to email me and I can consult with other staff and perhaps give you more information. But in general, they've transitioned into a variety of different kinds of ownership. I think some are probably still in ownership purgatory. I believe that some have come to us. There was sort of a four-step process for dealing with those properties, and I think one of the steps was probably initially going back to the original owner or the developer in determining if they wanted to accept responsibility for that site. So I know that's not information, but in general, there wasn't just one designation for those properties. There was a stepwise process that they went through. And again, if you would like to email me, I can get you some more specific information.
Okay, great. And our next question or questions come from Rory in Santa Ana, California. And the question is there an opportunity for mitigation banks or land trusts to be profitable? And do any land trusts currently generate a profit? For example, trail user fees or banking fees that generate revenue would be useful for research, restoration, and property acquisition.
I'll start with a response, and if Jessica or Palmer would like to enhance it, please feel free to do that. Profitable is a subjective term. We are, of course, a nonprofit organization, so in some sense of the term, the IRS sense of the term, we don't generate profit. However, like many nonprofit organizations, we can receive contributions. So even though the basis for our financial management of the preserve and the basis for maintaining our responsibilities for stewardship come from that financial planning process and endowment income, we nevertheless do accept contributions. So yes, on some of our preserves that have public access, there are boxes to receive public donations. So we receive a fairly modest amount of income from just contributions. And like many of you who work within nonprofit organizations, people are encouraged when they visit our website to make contributions. So we do have that second stream of income, but we don't use it as the basis of our financial planning because for us, that's not a firm foundation for providing stewardship. So yes, we do get additional income, voluntary contributions, and we do use those contributions for additional activities on the preserve. And sometimes that's in the form of enhancing the site for public education, putting up some educational signs or enhancing trails. And occasionally we might use it for research as well. And unfortunately, I probably can't ask Roy if I've answered his question. But again, you have my email address.
Megan, can you hear me?
Yeah, this is Palmer Huff, too. I just wanted to add a additional follow-up to Deborah's answer to the last question. The questioner asked whether or not mitigation banks can also be profitable. And just referring back to one of the slides in my first presentation, over, 70% of individual mitigation banks are actually sponsored by private entrepreneurs, and I think it's a safe bet to say that those folks are turning a profit on those projects as they're eager to get involved in more. So certainly there are folks, nonprofit folks involved in providing compensatory mitigation as well as for-profit folks, and both groups are doing great work.
Okay, great. Our next question comes from Jean in Richland, Washington. And Jean would like to know, can you provide a reference for guidance in performing due diligence?
I'm assuming that question is directed towards me. Within the center, we have, of course, standard practices, and we have checklists that we follow when we're doing the preparation for the PAR activity. And I don't see any reason why we couldn't share that checklist if that would be valuable to Eugene. So if that's the kind of thing you're referring to, again, please don't hesitate to email me.
Okay, and the next question comes from George in Linden, Washington. And George would like to know, is the PAR tool available? And if so, how and where?
Good question. And the PAR tool the center considers, first of all, should be made widely available because the center, in addition to its mission of managing preserves in perpetuity, also considers providing information based on their experience as being an important contribution to the general stewardship community. But it also believes that, like any piece of software, it requires some training and some provision of context. Otherwise, it could be used in a way that isn't useful and isn't going to serve the practitioner's objectives. So what the Center for Natural Lands Management is doing is sort of a controlled release of the software. And one of the ways in which it's releasing it at present is through seminars that are being conducted in collaboration with the EDA. And I think our webcast host can provide more information about that opportunity. But again, the idea here is to make that software available, but to do so in a context where the use of the software is well explained. So, and that may be changed, or the accessibility of that software may be increased in the future. I believe we're still determining what the best way in the future to make that software more available should be. But at the moment, you can't simply go to our website and download the software. It's being released through these educational workshops.
And at this time, we will turn to questions over the phone. And if you do have a question that you would like to ask, please unmute yourself and ask at this time. And please remember to state your name and organization before the question.
I have a question. My name is Carrie from Northeast Trees. We're a nonprofit organization in Los Angeles. And we work in urban areas, and we're working on a wetland stream restoration project in Los Angeles City. And I was wondering if there was some way that we could nominate it, you know, for a possible mitigation bank.
Palmer or Jessica?
This is Palmer Huff with EPA. I guess my first recommendation would be to approach your local district of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers with your proposal. As I mentioned in my first talk, the way that banks are approved, the bank proponent takes a proposal to the Corps, who runs an interagency review team that's composed of representatives from other federal and state agencies. And they'll work with you on your proposal and work through all the nuts and bolts of it and basically determine whether or not you have, you know, an adequate project to generate compensation credit under the 404 program, and work with you on the terms and conditions for how that bank would be operated. And ultimately, that if it moved forward, would take the form of a mitigation banking instrument. So your first stop then is your closest U.S. Army Corps of Engineer district.
Are there any other questions?
I have a question. My name's Susan Armstrong. I'm out of Dallas, Texas. And we're finding a situation possibly that there are no land trusts that are well-equipped to take easements with this type of project because of the due diligence required.
What
would you suggest in that case that we mention back to the project? Would that be a real estate mechanism that they need to fix, or what would you suggest?
This is Palmer Huff again with EPA. That's a really good question, and it's actually one of the reasons that we're doing this webcast and that EPA has partnered with the Environmental Law Institute and the Center for Natural Lands Management to run these two-day seminars that we're doing around the country. We're actually trying to reach out to the land trust community and build that capacity because, as many folks are aware, the land trust community is really the fastest-growing segments of the conservation community. There, I think some estimate between 1,400 and 1,700 of these organizations springing up around the country, and we really want to help build that capacity so they are there and have the ability to step up and hold easements or accept title on these compensation projects and do so in an effective manner. But you asked the reality question, which is what do you do when there isn't a land trust or another appropriate conservation organization on hand to provide that long-term stewardship? Well, the existing regulations and guidance require the mitigation provider, the permit applicant in the case of permittee responsible compensation, or the sponsors, banks, and NLFE programs to provide for the long-term protection and management of their sites if they can't find that steward. So it really is the responsibility of the permittee, if it's a permittee responsible compensation project, or the bank sponsor or NLFE sponsor, if that's the mechanism to provide that. We strongly encourage the conservation easements held by our fee title transfer to land trust or other conservation organizations or government agencies at the federal, state, or local level who have a land management responsibility and mission. If not, we have to fall back on sort of what some call the least effective tools for ensuring long-term site protection, and those are things like restrictive covenants and deed restrictions. They're really the sort of the bottom tier in terms of site protection mechanisms. And obviously the permittee or the bank sponsor, NLFE sponsor, or the landowner of those sites would be responsible then for providing the stewardship and be essentially beholden to the resource agencies for providing that in perpetuity.
And it looks like we have time for about one more question. So, again, if you do have a question, please unmute yourself, give us your name and organization, and then your question.
I have a question. My name is Bill Hilshey from Clearwater Conservancy, and this is a follow-up to that question for Palmer, that if you take the least protective mechanism to protect the property in perpetuity, you're essentially putting a deed restriction on a mitigation site, but I don't really see who would really enforce that deed restriction. Would the Army Corps be in contact with the permittee in perpetuity to make sure that that deed restriction is enforced?
We currently have a very imperfect system for tracking, particularly sites that have merely been protected with a restrictive covenant or a deed restriction. What we propose to do in the very near future is for all compensation sites to keep that information posted real time on the web so that not just the Army Corps of Engineers and the other resource agencies are aware of which sites are to be protected in perpetuity, but all the members of the public have access to that information as well. We certainly do not have adequate resources to continue to track and monitor all of these polygons of compensation around the country. As I mentioned earlier, we're adding tens of thousands of acres of these protected lands each year to compensate for permitted losses. The federal resource agencies and the state resource agencies aren't getting new personnel and new people to do that. So we're leveraging partnerships with grassroots conservation organizations who would be interested in partnering with us on that, the monitoring and stewardship of those sites. And we're also trying to leverage new technologies, i.e. posting this information on the web so that other interested parties in watersheds or in counties where compensation is happening can be aware and can be our eyes and ears on the ground and keep track of inappropriate activities that may be happening on sites that are supposed to be protected in folks' neighborhoods and counties and communities.
I think I understand your dilemma, but if there is a land trust that is willing to hold the easement, then Army Corps would require the permittee to have that land trust hold the easement. Would that be the case? What I'm getting at is I ran into a situation where a permittee may not have to work with a land trust, even though one may be available.
Sure.
Could you actually repeat?
Hey, Megan, am I? Can you hear me?
Yep.
It's my understanding that, Palmer can correct me if I'm wrong, though, that during the process of reviewing the mitigation plan, the permittee has to indicate who the long-term steward is going to be, and that's part of the negotiation process, in theory of the Corps and the other resource agencies that serve on the, if it's in the case of a bank, the mitigation bank review team, if it's in the case of just permittee responsible, then just the Corps, in theory that they should be evaluating whether or not the proposed long-term steward is would provide effective long-term stewardship of the site.
So that would be negotiated beforehand?
Yes.
Who the steward would be? Okay.
Yes, that's supposed to be the process. And I would just add in general to your question and the question before, Palmer in his presentation referenced this National Research Council report that came out in 2001 on compensatory mitigation. It was a very broad-based research study that was undertaken and published and critical of compensatory mitigation and success rate. And one of the recommendations in there was to promote the role of land trusts in taking on long-term stewardship because, as I mentioned, land trusts are the stewardship professionals in this country, and that's why we're having this webcast and designing this training course is that, the agencies do want to see land trusts taking on that role. They want to see them building their capacity to do so in response to the earlier Texas questioner, and to be in a position to, follow on some of the recommendations that Deborah made to have the fiscal savvy to request the adequate amount of long-term endowment to ensure that the mitigation will be protected in perpetuity and that the land trust won't be putting themselves in a precarious position. So, this whole process is part of an effort on behalf of the agency to increase the capacity of land trusts and their role in mitigation, and I would encourage anyone who's interested in delving further into this issue to contact one of us about the training courses that are being offered because it's a two-day course to talk about this issue, which we've had 2 hours to talk about.
Mm-hmm. And just if I could add a little footnote, Jill, to the extent that maybe your question referred to, how do we get enforcement pressure brought to bear on sites, and also how do we maintain that relationship in perpetuity? We are careful to ensure that whether it's Army Corps of Engineers, typically Army Corps of Engineers, but also sometimes Fish and Wildlife Service, if there are listed species involved too, we ensure that they're, of course, involved in the process, that, their contact information is well documented. We invest in a relationship with them. We keep them informed about the site over time. We send all of our annual reports and our annual plans to them so that we do keep them involved as partners throughout the duration of the project into perpetuity. And then secondly, we also are thinking ahead towards the possibility of, some sort of violations on the site if it's a conservation or mitigation bank, and build into our agreements as well as our financial plan, the probability and the cost of enforcement if we are holding a conservation easement, for example, over that bank.
Yes. Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this does officially conclude today's Watershed Academy webcast. On behalf of the entire EPA Watershed Academy webcast team, I'd like to thank Palmer Huff, Jessica Wilkinson, Rebecca Kisslinger, and Deborah Rogers for presenting or helping to present today. And, of course, thanks to every one of you who joined us. This is Megan Classic from the Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds signing off. Have a great day.